Pittsburgh, I love ya. This is Brian Edward, and you're listening to Berg Vivant, Pittsburgh's cultural talk magazine, delivered digitally, straight up, shaken, and stirred. Tonight's broadcast brought to you by our spectacular sponsors and strategic partners, Zafalo's Banquet and Event Center, Carnegie, Pennsylvania, one of the most beautiful and unique venues in the greater Pittsburgh area for weddings, corporate dinners, fundraisers, and more. Visit clubzafalo.com. Off the Wall Theater, enlivening, educating, and entertaining audiences in the Pittsburgh region. View their current season at insideoffthewall.com. Arcade Comedy Theater, hosting local and national comedians, sketch comedy, improv, and more. 811 Liberty Avenue, downtown. Be sure to like them on Facebook or find them at arcadecomedytheater.com. Berg Vivant is a proud supporter of Firefly Arts, creating opportunities and support for families living with autism through innovative arts programming. You can learn more and show your support at fireflyarts.org. Ed Dixon, thank you for gracing my beloved city of Pittsburgh with such talent and class and wit and charm. We are so glad to have you here,
sir. I'm so happy to be here. Let me tell you, I was walking to work the other day and I stepped off the curb and I suddenly had a flashback. I was looking at the surroundings. I've been in Pittsburgh every decade since maybe the late 60s. Now, not every year, but every decade.
Sure,
and I suddenly flashed on how many times I've been here, how many shows, how many different theaters. And it was just, I was just stepping off the curb and it was like, oh, will you look at that? You know, history.
You've got a good perspective and point of view on that. We've cleaned the place up a little bit, don't you think?
You know, I always loved Pittsburgh. I'm not just saying that. You know, there's a thing in the cosmos about, you know, people go to Pittsburgh and go, oh, steel town. You know, and it hasn't been a steel town since before I came here the first time 45 years ago.
That's true. You know? It's actually more of an arts and culture town than it is a steel town.
It is, and it's a beautiful town, and the landscape is beautiful, and the mountain is beautiful, and the downtown area is beautiful. The restaurants are beautiful. The first time was just a shock. Now it's just like, oh, yeah, Pittsburgh. I love Pittsburgh.
Now it's just a little shock. You know, it's just a jolt now.
It's not a shock.
Not at all.
I tell you what was a shock was I hadn't been in this building in the Pittsburgh Public Theater. I've been by it because I've worked at Heinz and I worked at the Benedum many times and always passing by and saying, oh, doesn't that look nice? But I hadn't been inside. This theater is beautiful and this room that we're in is so beautiful. And to rehearse here, you know, a lot of rehearsal rooms are not beautiful. You must know this.
I mean, just to have electricity and running water, I think we're fortunate.
Yes. I mean, this is a beautiful environment, and it's great to be here.
And we will definitely loop back around to what has brought you here, sir. But, you know, I've got to look into your past a bit. You know, sometimes the most challenging questions for me to come up with are the first ones, and it is tough. Where to begin with you?
I have done a lot of things.
You have. Yeah. And I mean, in just looking at your bio, you have been very successful in several fields. I more so than most people achieve in one. I mean, Broadway actor, writer, composer. Where do you find the time for this?
Well, I don't do anything else.
I'll tell you that. But you started early.
I did. I wrote three musicals, book, music, and lyrics, when I was in high school. I was that kid.
Yeah. Now, and we won't say what year, but I did read that you worked with Busby Berkeley. Is this true?
Now, this is something no one's going to say to you. At least I certainly don't imagine that they are. I worked with Busby Berkeley and Ruby Keeler. My Broadway debut was No, No, Nanette.
Wow.
And, you know, back then people didn't do old musicals. So for somebody to be mounting a musical from the 1920s, it was so radical. In the building next door was Pippin.
Wow.
And we were next door. You could hear it through the wall. And we were like, what are we doing here? T for two. And we all thought we were in a big bomb. And then we opened.
Wow.
Mega hit. That was really a shot. What a way to begin a career.
Now, classic films are a great passion of mine. What was it like working with Busby Berkeley?
Busby's days had passed.
Oh, okay.
It was the kind of thing it makes a great anecdote, but the stories that I have to tell about Busby wouldn't be very nice, because he really was very, what was nice was Ruby Keeler. You know, you watch those old movies, how beautiful she was, and at age 60 she was so beautiful, and she had this personality like somebody's sweet mom from Iowa. Can I bake you cookies? You
know, I like hearing that about her.
She was so sweet and dear, you know. My favorite thing that ever happened with her, we were on stage, 2,000 people in the audience, and she had a frog in her throat, and she was talking to Helen Gallagher, and she, she kept trying to, and finally she looked out at the audience and went, "Excuse me." It's really one of the funniest things I ever saw.
Stage manners
on Broadway.
Excuse me. Now, I'm sure you've got a million answers to this question, but give me the first name that comes to your mind when I say actor that you're dying to work with again.
Anne Margaret.
Really?
Anne Margaret was the dearest, sweetest, kindest, most loving, most glamorous, and I never got over it. It's like when we were rehearsing together, she'd just had an accident, so she was all bandaged up, and she didn't wear makeup, and she usually had on some kind of turban. She was always hiding her hair.
And the show was Best Little Whorehouse
in Texas, which we also recorded, and we did it for a year and a half of one-weekers. And when I saw her, she came and she'd just been in an accident, and I thought, big Broadway star, she's just hurt herself, she's not going to make it through 3 weeks, because one-weekers, I don't know if you know this, one-weekers are hard. Mm. You're always moving on the day off, you know. I thought, you know, maybe three. She made it the whole year and a half, 1 week at a time, different city every week, and was pleasant, kind, generous. I lost my train of thought, as usual. The first time I saw her as Anne Margaret was opening night, because that was the night she came in early.
Oh, wow.
She put on the $10,000 Bob Mackie gown. She had on the Anne Margaret hair, the Anne Margaret makeup, and some kind of perfume. I've never smelled anything like this in my life. It was her perfume. She walked out of her dressing room in this waft of dense jungle perfume, looking like Anne Margaret. And she was really nervous. So she just came walking toward me, and she just kept walking, and she just planted her face right in the middle of my chest, like scared. And I put my arms around her, and I was like, "Anne Margaret." And I never got over that. It always felt like that.
Oh, you know? Wow.
She's a star.
Did Bob Mackie ever design for you?
No. I don't think I'm his target audience.
But now, as a writer and composer, I mean, you've got more Drama Desk Award nominations. You've got more Drama Desks than Levin's Furniture Warehouse. So certainly, you're very accomplished. Shylock, the musical, is one of your Drama Desk nominations.
This was an amazing moment in my life. It was a short-lived thing. We produced it on a shoestring. It cost almost nothing to do. I got it done. I wrote an opera out of The Merchant of Venice, got it produced in New York, and starred in it. I was so, you know, I didn't know you couldn't do that. And it ran just a short time, and it was over, and I get this call. People used to have answer machines in the old, and I come home, I turn on the answer machine, and it's the press agent saying, "Ed, you've been nominated for Best Actor. You're nominated with Mandy Patinkin, Robert Lindsay, and Combe Wilkinson." Combe Wilkinson, I was nominated opposite him in Les Mis, which cost like $50 million in my little show. And I thought it was a joke. And I'm like, "How dare you leave me this rude message?" And then I picked up the paper, and there it was. You know?
Wow. And you did the music, the book, the lyrics. Why don't you just design the set, too?
Not good that way.
That
would be pushy.
And a vocalist, I must assume, since you had the distinction of being part of the Kennedy Center's premiere of Bernstein's The Mass.
I was so young, you know, that I didn't even know how. You know, when you're young, you just take things for granted. There we are, opening the John F. Kennedy Center. All of the Kennedys are there. Leonard Bernstein is there. Alvin Ailey is there, the entire original Alvin Ailey dance company, and we're all interacting, and you know, you're young and you're stupid, and you just think, "Oh, so this is what life is going to be like now." Good, you know. And of course, it's once in a lifetime.
Yeah.
You know? And I look back on it like, "Oh my God, what an amazing thing."
Yeah, it's a great variety of success. What do you credit it to? Is it luck? Is it good fortune? Is it
luck is always the final ingredient. You know, you can work yourself to the ground, you can do all the right things, say all, but if luck doesn't decide to go, I mean, you have to be in the right configuration for luck to tap you on the shoulder. You have to do the work, but doing the work doesn't guarantee you anything. I mean, I do think you have to go at it all day, every day. I coach a lot of people, and I see people who want to be successful the way a secretary would go at it, being as, sorry to insult secretaries, but that mindset, I'll do as little as possible and work as few hours as possible, whereas you have to do it like an executive. You have to come in before everybody else and stay longer and still be there when everybody else is, and you have to do it every day. People wish me happy weekend. I'm like, same kind of day for me.
What's a weekend? But I imagine, you know, be a successful playwright, for example, you need to be working around the clock to pursue that. But yet again, you know, you've had great success as an actor, a composer, a vocalist too.
Well, it's in waves. You know, I see someone like Ted Pappas, who runs a place like this, and he has six projects going all the time. I'll push really hard at this project, and then that gets going. And then I push really hard at this, and then I go really hard at this audition. I don't feel like I do like six things at once all the time. Like some, I mean, I usually have a few things going, but like to get a play started takes a really strong initial wave, and then rewrites don't take that kind of time. And you send it out to people, or in my case, everything is from personal relationships. I know so many people. I can call people up and say, "Will you look at this?" That doesn't take that much time. But that initial getting the groundwork done, laying the initial draft of it, that's time consuming.
Now, speaking of Ted Pappas, there's a loaded segue for
yes.
you. I would presume that you have a high opinion of the Pittsburgh Public Theater, seeing as how you have trusted them with the world premiere of your latest work, L'Hotel. L'Hotel. Okay, so that is the correct. Okay.
Yeah. Fair. It's the French word for hotel, because it takes place in a hotel. And I mean, actually, this idea came from Ted. We had a meeting years ago about developing a project, and Ted said, "I've always wanted somebody to write a play about Père Lachaise," and I didn't know what Père Lachaise was, so I'm like, "What?
Is it a perfume? Yeah. Is it a wine?"
And he told me it's the most famous cemetery in the world. It's in Paris, and half the famous people in the world are buried there. And he handed me a sheet of paper that had a list of about 50 of the really luminaries that
he just happened to have that on him.
I think he had this planned.
Oh, okay. Either that, or he just has weird hobbies.
It was sitting right there, you know? And I didn't get it right away that what a good idea it was, but about 6 hours later I went, wait a minute.
Okay.
And that was one of those things. For about 28 days I wrote around the clock and had a first draft, you know, and that was, you know, I started to say arduous. It isn't arduous, because when you're like that, you want to do it. You just can't wait to get back to when you've got an idea. Yeah. I don't always have an idea like that. You know, it just comes when it comes. Sometimes I go long periods of time where I'm not pursuing an idea. But this, I thought this was such a good idea that within about a month, I had a really major draft. And what we're working on today is about the 1,000th draft. We're way into the process.
Have you ever had one just come out perfect?
Oh, God, no. I mean, I have had things kind of belch out the way they were going to go. Cloak and Dagger, which was just in D.C., I got an idea, and I made an outline. And when the thing was up, it followed that outline, you know, pretty much to a T. There were a million additions and subtractions along the way, but that initial outline was really the arc of the show.
Now, it's not a great spoiler to reveal that most of the characters in your play are deceased.
Yes, that is not a spoiler.
Okay, I can edit that out.
But yes.
I just figure most people know that going in. Also that, you know, is inspired by this very famous cemetery. And, you know, to read the description, we've got the likes of Jim Morrison, Sarah Bernhardt, Oscar Wilde, all find themselves in this hotel. Now, I imagine that you put some of these personalities together and it kind of writes itself, maybe. I mean, not to diminish your craft, but it's a great concept.
It's absolutely true. When I, it's really a, there are six of these famous people. There's the poor, beleaguered waiter who has to take care of all of them in perpetuity, which is a story unto itself. And then there's a young woman who comes to the scene. She's the only living person in the play. But when you put this particular group of people together, there's a particular kind of chemistry that happens. And it did do a lot of the writing itself.
So why these six figures in particular?
I scanned that list that Ted gave me originally, and of course I did a lot of homework after that. I had a response to these people. Some of them, like Victor Hugo, I did Les Miserables 1,700 times in the original production of Les Mis. And so reading the full-length version of Les Mis is a spectacular experience. Everyone should have that experience. I mean, it's one of the truly great novels. And so I had a real relationship with him. I'd done a lot of research at one point about Duse, the great competitor of Bernhardt, and I was fascinated by the fact that Bernhardt was so outward and so flashy, and Duse was so internal and real, and that was interesting to me. The fact that Jim Morrison was there, and he's the most popular of all these great, great people, the most visited, the most beloved in this seminar, which is hilarious all on its own. And so I thought, how would they react to that? You know, Rossini. I one of the 4 million things I've done in my life. I had a foray into opera. I studied it in school, and I ran away to Germany at one point to be an opera singer. I toured with New York City Opera. I was with Santa Fe Opera. That's a whole separate chapter. And Rossini, poor Rossini, is the butt of all the jokes because he just looks so funny. I mean, you see pictures of Rossini, and you're like, he's got to be the fall guy, and that's what he is in this play.
So what can we expect from observing the world premiere of this play?
Well, I'll tell you one thing, it's going to look like $1 million.
Yep.
The set by James Noon, he's a designer I've worked with before, he's fantastic. The set is beautiful, and it has to do with Ted's concept. It's a beautiful concept. He wanted this hotel to be very old world and very glamorous, and it's gigantic. You can see the beginnings of it now. There's a staircase that could be at the Paris Opera. I mean, it's thrilling.
And we are in the rehearsal space for the show right now.
Yes.
It's getting its finishing touches week and next before it goes up, and I think we might even be in chairs that will be used on the set.
These chairs are on the set.
This is an honor. So this is going to be theater history here. Now, this is not your first time at the rodeo for world premieres. So, I mean, how do you feel like the night before? Do you get nervous?
You know, I was just in the theater this morning taking pictures, and like to see them building a thing that a few years ago was this idea in my head, it's very thrilling, you know. And to see I know some of these actors from before, they're wonderful actors, and to see really wonderful actors learning your lines and they do lots and lots of homework. So, you know, the one who's playing Bernhardt is reading all these books on Bernhardt, and Oscar Wilde is reading, so it takes on all these characteristics of its own. It's very thrilling. Watching something that you wrote is one of the most painful things I've ever experienced. Like every missed line, every missed laugh, every word that gets turned around or put in the wrong place, every audience member who opens a candy or turns on a cell phone or starts chatting with their neighbor, it is like having acid poured over your head. It's, of all the things I've done in my life, the hardest thing is to sit there and watch it go on its own, where you have no role. You're just sitting there.
You suffer for your art.
You know, it sounds stupid, but it's a kind of pain. I think it must be what it's like if you have a 4-year-old and you're going to send them off to play school, and you just don't want to. You don't want anything to go wrong.
It's
your
baby.
You don't really want to let them go, but you don't want to. You know.
Well, I wish you all the peace and tranquility on opening night that the fates can afford. But at this part in the process, with just kind of a few weeks left, you're here, you're working with the cast and crew. What really is your role at this point?
We've done rewrites every single day.
Really?
Yes, and we'd made some changes today, and then just as I was walking out of the building, Ted made one more change, and he said, is it okay if I do that? I'm like,
oh, I'm glad he asked you.
Yeah. Well, that's a legal issue.
So he's glad he asked.
I want to double back for a second.
Sure,
because to talk about what it's like to watch a piece that's running on its own and you don't have a role in it as well, but this process has been very joyful. Like, it is to be in a beautiful place with beautiful people. We've had time. This isn't a rush job, so we've gotten to like spend time with each piece of it. We've gotten to talk about each idea in the play, and there's been a kind of largesse about it that you often don't have. You know, oftentimes you just get it up and go, you know. And there's a kind of fun in that too, but this has been really joyful and gracious. So.
A positive chapter in your book. And there is such a thing.
You have
written your memoirs.
Yes.
Now, I think that is the mark of a true personality, when you have gotten to the point when you pen your memoirs. Not just write your autobiography, pen your memoirs.
Yes.
And I love the title, Secrets of a Life on Stage, .. and off.
Yes.
Now, if that's not a compelling title.
A lot has happened.
I would guess.
But here's to double back again. Mm. One of the main reasons I wanted to write that book is because some of the things that transpired between me and Ruby Keeler and Busby Berkeley were so unique and so hilarious and so once in a lifetime. And with Bernstein and the opening of the Kennedy Center, if I don't write those particular stories down, that's a long time ago. We're talking 1971 here. If I don't write those down, those stories are just going to be gone.
Right.
And that was a very strong, compelling factor. You know?
One of the pieces of advice I always hear is, you know, there's no one clear-cut path to success. Everyone has their own unique one. And, you know, looking at your career, I think it was very unique and
yes.
certainly, you know, worthy of a book. What do you feel is some of the best advice you've ever been given in your career?
I don't know that I was given this advice, but this is the advice. This is the advice I would give. Treat it like a full-time job. Mm. You know, if you want to be an actor, for instance, and you go at it, say 8 hours a day, reading plays, studying plays, going to plays, going to acting class, taking voice class, doing all the things. If you do that 8 hours a day for 6 months, you will have been an actor for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
But what people do is dream about it. You know, oh, it'd be so great if I was making a movie. You know, that is not how it works. Whatever it is you want to do, go at it, tooth and tong. And the difficulty with that is if you do and you fail, you've given us your all, so you've really failed. And I think most of us don't want to risk that, you know.
And here we are pretty much on the eve of what will be one of your most recent successes. What do you consider your first great success?
Getting into No No Nanette was really, it was an extraordinary, you know, you haven't been on Broadway and you think you'll never be on Broadway and you're going to open calls and trying this and trying, you just don't have a clue which end is up, and then all of a sudden somebody goes, be in my show, be in my Broadway show, you know, be in my Broadway show with some great big stars. Something happens, you know, it's like this magical thing has happened. You were outside the circle and boom, now you're inside the circle. And when you realize how invisible that line is, I was over here, now I'm over here. You might start to realize that could happen anywhere. That could be the case anyway. And it always has that kind of magical feel. You didn't have it, now you do.
So it seems like everything's just been coming up, Ed. So I have to ask you, what do you feel, looking back, has been your greatest disappointment?
Well, if you read the book, you know that I had a great debacle in the 1980s. I really drove the car right off the road, as a lot of people did in the 1980s. And I would say that my life today is a result of that. You know, when you've had a real, genuine debacle in your life, when you've really wrecked the car, you know, you have a different kind of perspective on life. And I really credit everything good today with what bad happened in the 1980s.
Mm. I have a feeling that's going to be a good read. I'm looking forward to that. Mm. The Secrets of a Life on Stage, and off, of course. And of course, L'Hotel here, opening at the Pittsburgh Public November 13th to December 14th. That's about a full month there.
That is a full month.
You got quite a run.
Yes, yes. Very nice. And it's a big theater. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they do a lot of great work here. And,
yes, they do. Oh, I just saw the Glass Menagerie that is absolutely beautiful. Beautiful production.
So what is next for you after the show's up?
I was great friends with George Rose, the famous character actor. I think he was the greatest character actor of the 20th century. He was my friend and mentor for 20 years, and he was murdered in the Dominican Republic, and I was down there and met the people who killed him. And that happened in 1988. It was a huge event in my life to have my mentor be murdered. And January, Richie Ridge, who does Broadway Beat, and you know, said to me, he'd read my book, and he said, Ed, you should do a one-man show about George Rose. And a gong went off in my head. And that was one of those things, 28 days later, I had a pretty good draft of that. And it's really moving forward. There's a lot
Wonderful.
Of interest in it. You know, so that's going to be...
And what a lovely tribute, too.
Yeah, I mean, he was a really major... I learned when you... tour with someone like that who knows those kind of tricks. He was from the Royal Shakespeare Company and the Old Vic. He worked with John Gielgud, Ralph Richardson, Laurence Olivier. Like to get to interact with somebody who's done that.
Yeah.
Oh, I forgot to mention, I'm about to do a new Broadway show based on...
Just by the way.
Based on Hee Haw. It's called...
What?
It's, yes, Dig It. I can't tell you the shock it was when I walked into that room and found out how funny... And how good Brandy Clark, the spectacular country western singer, did the score. It's out of this world. And Robert Horn, a television writer, wrote this hilarious book. And we're going out of town with it in a few months.
That's, who's playing Minnie Pearl?
Minnie Pearl is not in it,
what?
Oddly enough. Yes. You know.
Now, that's the first thing that's coming to my mind when I hear Hee Haw. But, hey, there could be rewrites.
There could be. I'm playing Grandpa. So.
Oh, very nice. Yes. Very. Well, we'll look forward to that. Now, what is it called?
It's called Moonshine.
Okay, Moonshine. Yeah. I think you did say that. Because could they call it Hee Haw?
They could. That's a long story.
Yeah, that's another,
that would take us off the rails.
That's another legal thing there. Well, now, on the subject of one-man shows, of course, what I see is, the Ed Dixon one-man show. Who's going to play you?
Well, in this version, it's me. So I am still here.
Yeah, Ed Dixon as himself. I mean, that I would go to see that.
Oh, thank you.
And I have had a pleasure sort of observing it tonight. This kind of has been, the Ed Dixon show. But really a great wealth of knowledge and great great stories. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you.
And
great to be here.
Yeah, we're looking forward to seeing the show and whatever else you're shaking out of your sleeves in the future. But wishing you all the best. And, thanks again for enjoying Pittsburgh. You know, it's nice to hear... somebody who's really been around, look upon our city with a lot of... Come back and see us anytime.
Thank you.
In closing, we would like to once again thank our spectacular sponsors and strategic partners, Off the Wall Theater, Cefalo's Banquet and Events Center, Carnegie, Pennsylvania, Arcade Comedy Theater, Downtown, and Bergvavant is a proud supporter of Firefly Arts, creating opportunities and support for families living with autism through innovative arts programming. Find out more and show your support at fireflyarts.org. And be sure to follow Pittsburgh's Cultural Talk magazine online. You can find Bergvavant, the It in Pittsburgh, on Facebook, Twitter, or subscribe for free at www.bergvavant.com. This is Brian Edwards saying cheers and good night.